Welcome one, welcome all. Deep fat fried, suck my balls. Yeah.
Why are we so dark?
Ah.
There you go. Shed some light.
Because you're blinded by the light.
Bump, 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 wrapped up like a douche. Another roamer in the night.
Wish Ian McKellen was here. That'd be cool.
Ian,
yeah,
who?
I mean, I don't think I'd be doing this show if Ian McKellen was here. Everything would be
Why
chilling.
Not? We'd be doing the show.
We'd be
with
smoking
Ian
weed with Ian McKellen.
Yeah. Yeah, dude, fuck that. The clubs don't need to see that.
We need bring your Paul can bring his church warden pipe.
Yeah,
we can have Gandalf fucking take a puff, dude.
That's right.
On the road where it began.
Yeah, dude, just singing songs and passing the pipe, you know.
Singing
what happens if Ian McKellen gets handsy with you, Paul? What are you gonna do?
I'm gonna let him.
I'm about to say you better, dude. If it's
I
me,
mean, like what
if
man?
It's
wouldn't...
me. I'm taking one for the team. If it's
yeah,
though,
dude. Gandalf wants to fuck me. I'm not saying no. I'm sorry.
Can't say no, dude.
Sorry,
can't
I gotta
say
take one.
No to Gandalf because he's just.
And he is that, dude. He is just Gandalf. I mean, he's not just Gandalf, but he's Gandalf in my mind forever. Like, that was a perfect cast. Say what you want about the goddamn movies. That character was cast perfectly.
Mm.
There's nobody else that I think could have done it justice the way Ian McKellen did.
Ian McKellen.
Goddamn, man. Now I just want to go watch The Lord of the Rings.
You know, they wanted to cast Sean Connery in that role.
Sean Connery.
Oh my god, dude. Thank goodness they didn't.
I love Sean Connery, but he is totally wrong for that role.
I'm Gandalf or whatever. You shan't pass, I tell you.
Oh my god. Yeah, it would have been
a disaster.
It would have been hilariously bad, though. You know what? In the other fucking Mandela Effect universe where we get that, dude. That's probably a pretty fucking notoriously bad film. Like, remember the first Lord of Rings movie? They never even put out the sequels. They filmed them all, but they never put any of them out.
Because Gandalf was just so awful.
Yeah, Gandalf ruins the movies.
I don't know. I don't agree. I think Gandalf is amazing. I think he's awesome.
Well, yeah.
You like, because Ian McKellen played him.
No. Yeah. I'm talking about Sean Connery.
Oh, so you've been to that other multiverse.
Yeah, I went to that other universe, and actually he killed it.
Cool, dude.
You wouldn't even fucking, you'd be like Ian McHugh. If you saw Sean Connery,
if I could see it and it's like that, dude, I'll agree with you.
It was amazing.
Give me a fucking trip, interdimensional trip or whatever it is, dude.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So let's talk about murder, I guess.
Oh, do we have to?
Murder.
Murder most foul.
According to the Bible, the first murder to ever take place was brother slaying brother.
Oh, shit.
Sometimes you got to do what you got to do.
Mm-hmm. And anyone who has a brother knows exactly what Cain was going through.
Yeah.
We're supposed to love our families and not kill them. Society expects that of us. God, apparently, expects that of us. Even evolution expects that of us. Gotta preserve those selfish genes, after all. Despite all of that, some of us still end up slaughtering our family members with glee. Welcome to a salacious, exploitative, and downright fucked up episode of Deep Fat Fried.
Woo! Nice, TJ. Clap, clap.
Let's get right in to the gory details of some kin-killing mayhem.
Yes, yes.
What sayest thou, gentlemen?
I'm stoked. I'm ready to go.
All right.
You got me pumped, TJ. You got me fucking pumped to hear about some people going crazy and murdering their families.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, he did it. He did it.
I said this guy kind of looked
guilty.
Like a skinny white guilt Paul.
Well, I hate to admit it, but he kind of does. It's... the only difference is that there's not existential terror in those eyes. There's kind of a very, very on the surface malice there.
Yeah, this
but
guy.
He cuts the same
do
kind
you know
of
who
profile.
This is? Either you recognize
I don't.
This guy?
I don't know.
This dude is named Bradford Bishop.
Okay.
Okay. So let me tell you a little bit about.
Proper name?
Yeah. Let me tell you a little bit about this guy. So he was born in August of 1936. He grew up an only child in Southern California, just like Paul, except he had sisters, I guess.
I have, like, you know, very unlike Paul. And I wasn't in Southern California, I was in Central California.
Whatever. But Southern
whatever.
Enough.
Yeah, okay.
His father was a petroleum geologist. His mother was a homemaker. Like his father, Bishop attended Yale University, where he received his bachelor's degree in American Studies. In August 1959, not long after graduating, he married...
What the fuck do you do with a bachelor's degree in American
yeah,
studies?
Yeah, I was kind of just wondering that.
Just a history teacher?
Or? I will tell you what he did
okay,
in a
all
moment.
Right, sorry.
Is he a basket weaver?
He married Annette Weiss, with whom he would have three sons, including his namesake, William Bradford Bishop III.
The third?
So he's a junior, just like Paul.
Fuck you for trying to draw this parallel between me and this freak.
Dude, I'll tell you what, though, man. It's really something special to be a third, dude. Because being a junior...
I'm a third.
Yeah, I know. That's what I'm saying. You made very few thirds. Like, juniors are so common.
Because juniors hate... Like, most juniors hate being juniors.
Yes.
It's caused nothing but like, fucking bullshit in my life, being a junior. Not to say... You know, like, I don't mind sharing a name with my dad or whatever. That ain't it. It's just... There have been, like, times where I get mail of his or he gets mail that I need of mine.
Or there's times when the DMV refuses to give you a fucking state ID. Because
I had to go reorder my social security card because it doesn't say junior on it and they wouldn't give me a fucking driver's license. It's just absurd. Like, there was a time where his credit report got mixed up with mine doing was going on my credit report for a while.
Damn.
Took 3 years to sort that all out.
That sucks.
It's absurd, man. Fuck naming your kids the same thing as you.
But this guy did it, Paul. Another reason to hate him. Another dark reflection.
So after leaving college, Bishop spent 4 years in the U.S. Army. He became a military intelligence specialist. He was assigned to work in military counterintelligence in Yugoslavia.
With American studies degree? With a bachelor's in American studies?
Yep. Well, it was from Yale, too.
Oh, I guess that makes sense.
So during this time,
it's the military, too.
He mastered 4 foreign languages.
Well, shit, he's pretty... there you go.
Italian, French, Serbo-Croatian, and Spanish. So this guy speaks 5 languages.
He's a brain.
Include English.
He's a brain.
In 1964, he went back to college, or he actually finished his another stint at college where he earned a master's degree in international studies.
Huh.
From Middlebury College in Vermont. He also holds a master's degree in African studies from UCLA.
This is a smart dude.
Yeah,
this is a reader.
Educated, yeah.
Yeah, you know.
Yes, and because of his pretty evident intellect, in 1965, he was being looked at as a candidate for the State Department. By December of 1965, he got his first assignment as a junior officer in Ethiopia. And according to his colleagues, he was pretty much a total self-important, narcissistic tool about it. This is a guy who, according to his coworkers, colleagues, friends, whatever, was basically, he thought of himself, as soon as he got in the State Department, he was going around acting like he was James Bond. Like, he thought that he was, like, this super awesome secret agent man kind of fucking guy.
Meanwhile, he's just working for an embassy.
Yeah, and he's just, you know, he's not doing that kind of work, but that's how he's thinking of himself. This streak of narcissistic self-importance is part of his life. And all these intellectual achievements you can kind of see are all to...
They're all laurels.
They're all... Yeah, they're all... He's wearing them all on his fucking chest like badges of his own superiority, basically.
If he meets someone, they're knowing about all his degrees and all his accomplishments. So he's like very effusive with praise for himself.
So. Right. So very narcissistic guy. Very self-obsessed. Very self-important. So the Bishops had 3 sons in the 60s and 70s. There was Brad, who was nicknamed Pino, who was born in 1961. That's his oldest son. Brenton, who was born in 1965. And Jeffrey, the baby, came along in 1971.
Damn, 10 years difference between them.
Yep. So here's another picture of him here.
Oh, he looks like a douche.
Yeah, he was.
I mean,
you know he's a douche. We're talking about family murder at this point.
If I just looked at this guy and was like, and I had no background context, like, is this someone you'd want to chill with? It's like, fuck no, it looks like a fucking total asshole. This looks like a fucking high school principal or something.
Yeah, and despite all outward appearances, successful, worked for the State Department, doing well for himself, got a family, got a wife. You know, got a nice house,
educated, has everything.
Super well educated.
He pretty much has like the American dream.
Right. I mean, like, this is, you know, you look at this guy, his life from the outside, you see all this American dream kind of shit. There wasn't really much an indication of what was going on inside.
So there wasn't like some diary or notes or.
But there was, a diary was found.
Okay, it was.
But years later.
So at the time, it was kind of just like, it just seemed...
So I'm going to actually read you an excerpt from a diary that was... this is an entry from August of 1967. So this is... At this point, he's got 2 kids. He's working for the State Department. Here's what he wrote. I am getting better. I am on the threshold. I recognize now that to twist my accursed confines, I must develop continuing and constant sense of surging for confidence, awe, and becoming, and love. This is my greatest challenge, for this has always been the great impediment to freedom and total self-realization, to burst the bounds. I have no idea what he means, but that sounds like some fucking Red Dragon shit.
Yeah, that sounds...
Yes.
Yeah, it sounds like
the... You owe me awe!
Yeah.
You know?
Not a well-mind, you know? I can't even really tell what headspace he's in there.
So here's another entry from October of 1971. This is just around the time his wife is either pregnant or has just given birth to his kid. I don't know exactly. I know his kid. I know his last of three kids was born in 1971. I don't know if it's October 1971. We can assume the kid's probably been born.
Sure.
So we can say he's got a newborn in the house at this point. 4 years have passed. Your family grows more beautiful. He's referring to himself as not an I, but a you at this point.
Yeah.
Like he's talking to himself through the pages. 4 years have passed. Your family grows more beautiful, and you still stand on the threshold. Equals, outwardly, your accomplishments are great. Equals, my, quick symbols. Equals, promotions, citations, languages, degrees. Still, you stand on the threshold.
So it almost sounds like he's like, he felt like he was due something that he wasn't getting. You know what I mean? For all his hard work and all his accolades and his big brain.
Yes.
He still felt he's like obsessed. He was waiting outside in the cold.
He's obsessed with this threshold.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He's at the threshold of greatness. But
he uses it in both of these. He says, I am on the threshold in the first entry that we read from 67.
And I guess there's never a description of what he believes this threshold is.
I don't know, because I tried to find if I could read his entire diary somewhere, and I couldn't find that.
That can be taken a number of ways.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I'm at the threshold of something horrible, or I'm at the threshold of something new and brilliant and different, or, you know, I don't know. It would have been interesting to hear what was beyond that threshold in his mind.
Yeah.
But maybe there was nothing. Maybe it was just this perpetual sense of spinning his wheels no matter how good he was.
So as the years progressed, the cursive in his diary grew bigger, more jagged, and more erratic. So they say that, you know, you read this diary, you can actually see sort of him losing his grip through the writing.
Hmm.
Because it starts very ordered and within the lines and neat, and it gets big and it gets jagged and it gets, you know, distorted.
I mean, a way to view this too could be that, you know, he lived this normal life because he thought, like, if I do all these things, not only is that the life I need to lead to have success, but this is how I'm supposed to fit into society. This is how I fit in. And then the threshold, you know, maybe that could be almost interpreted as like, that's him saying, I just can't hold it. Like you said, like if you see throughout a progression like that, maybe his mind was just like, you know, the urge to kill was just too strong.
Urge to kill, rising. After being passed up for a promotion on March 1st, 1976.
So failure.
Bishop left work early, claiming that he was not feeling well. After work, he drove to some local stores and purchased the following items. A mini sledgehammer, seen here. A gas can, which he filled up at a nearby gas station. A shovel and a pitchfork.
Wow. What's he got planned?
No one knows. Nobody knows, Paul.
He had to hammer some nails. He had to move some hay.
Yeah, you know.
He had a tractor that he needed to fuel up.
Yeah, you makes I mean? Total sense.
Sounds like a normal shit to me.
Makes total sense. So here's his wife and kids. So at around 8 p.m., Bishop returned to his Bethesda home and to his family. Annette Bishop, 37, an artist who had set aside her interest to raise the boys, was sitting on the floor reading a book. The boys were in their rooms, asleep in their pajamas. Bradford walked up behind his wife and smashed her repeatedly in the back of the head with a sledgehammer that he'd purchased. Bishop's mother, Lobelia, 68, had been out walking the family dog, a golden retriever named Leo. When she came back inside, Bishop beat her to death as well. That's his own mother.
Yeah.
Then, with his wife and mother dead at his hands, he went upstairs and beat each of his three sons to death. At this time, they were aged 5, 10, and 14. And for whatever reason, he saved the most savage blows for his oldest son, Pino. An autopsy showed that he was hit with a violence and anger far beyond what the others had suffered.
So the other people in his family he just killed. It was like, you're dead.
I mean, did they consider that it might have been because he was the only one in the house that really could physically oppose him, and he wanted to make doubly sure that
could be
he was incapacitated, you know? Because, yeah, like, if he was 14 at that, you know, a 14-year-old could fight back.
Yep.
You know?
Yeah, for sure.
Really, all these three other of people didn't really get a chance to.
Exactly.
Well, and I mean, it also could have been, too, because, like I said, you know, he lived this life that he felt he was supposed to live, and he sees his young son that has all these things ahead of him, and it's, like, the anger coming out, like, you ruined, or it could be, you ruined my life, it could be, I mean, it's just, it's kind of interesting to get in the psychology of these people, because, like, I guess, especially when you don't have much to really go on, like, because obviously, like you said, there's a diary, but we don't have access to that, I guess.
Right.
Yeah, and, you know, it just makes a lot of vague allusions to the threshold and, I mean, and the awe.
And also reading it, I don't think you necessarily would just see something like, this is why I killed them, I'm evil, you know, you're not going to get that kind of
shit.
Yeah,
you're probably not going to get too much insight there.
Yeah.
All three of the kids are thought to have died in their beds, so no one ever woke up and fought back or anything like that. They were just bludgeoned to death with a hammer as they slept.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Blood spatters and droplets were found throughout the house. He then loaded their bodies into his station wagon, packed himself some basic supplies, and hit the road with his dog, Leo, whom he spared. Only okay. Member of the family to get spared.
Okay, so that is actually bizarre.
Yeah, I mean, I guess he just figured, like, no point in killing the
family.
Yeah,
man's
dog.
Best friend.
Hey, what did Leo do?
Yeah, yeah. Leo didn't do nothing but
Leo, them. You're the only one who didn't contribute to my madness. You get to live. Some witnesses say that they saw him later in the company of a dark-skinned woman, but that's not confirmed.
So just kind of scuttlebutt was that he was palling around. Maybe there might have been an accomplice or something.
Yeah, possibly.
Or like a secret mistress?
Yeah, potentially.
Motive.
There was kind of that idea that maybe he killed his family so he could get with his mistress.
But the timing, too. I mean, obviously, he's passed up for a career thing.
Or like, it could have just been some people who mistook what they saw, you know?
Right.
Well, as you see that his career trajectory, I mean, like you said, everything before just been positive, positive, positive. Then it's like, okay, well, this other
candidate. A lot of people remarked that it was like almost like the first bump in the road just totally snapped him. Because, I mean, despite getting passed up for that promotion, he was still doing well at work. He had this, he wanted to be an ambassador by the time he was 50. That was his big ambition, is he wanted to be a U.S. ambassador. And when he got passed up for that promotion, I guess he just thought, like, fuck this. I'm never going to be an ambassador. I'm fucking kidding myself. I'm just going to kill my family with a hammer. I don't know.
Then maybe that was what he was at the threshold of, being an ambassador, like a national, you know.
Maybe that's what he was waiting for.
Politician.
Anyway, he took their bodies 275 miles away to a wooded swamp near Columbiana, North Carolina. There he burned their remains. That's what the gas can was for, I guess. And buried them. He was never caught.
So nobody knows where he is?
No.
Oh.
This is a age-progressed sculpture of Bishop by Karen T. Taylor.
Dude, I know that guy.
On April 10th, 2014, the FBI placed him on its 10 most wanted fugitives. On June 27th, 2018, Bishop, who would be 81, was removed from the list, making room, the FBI said, for a dangerous fugitive. However, he is still being actively pursued by the FBI.
I mean, he's probably dead.
Until they have some confirmation that he's dead, they're still looking for him.
Sure.
Now, there have been some possible sightings. In July of 1978, a Swedish woman who said she had collaborated with Bishop while on a business trip in Ethiopia reported she had spotted him twice in a public park in Stockholm during a span of 1 week. She stated she was absolutely certain that the man was Bishop. She did not contact the police at the time because she had not yet realized he was wanted for murder in the U.S.
I mean, it makes sense that this is a guy that could have very easily lived overseas, and that's probably what he did.
I mean, that, I can almost guarantee.
He speaks multiple languages.
Yeah. Right.
He's obviously a very intelligent person.
So he could live. He probably lives in a number of places. He probably travels around and bounces from country to country. I mean,
assuming he's still alive to this day, which he might not be.
He might not be. Yeah.
You know, he'd be 81. But
he might have died and been given a normal funeral as somebody else somewhere else in the world years ago.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
There's just nowhere to know.
In January 1979, Bishop was reportedly seen by a former U.S. State Department colleague in a restroom in Sorrento, Italy. The colleague greeted the bearded man, whom he personally believed to be Bishop, eye to eye, asking the man impulsively, "Hey, you're Brad Bishop, aren't you?" The man panicked suddenly, responding in a distinctly American accent, "Oh, no." He then ran swiftly out of the restroom and fled into the Sorrento alleyways.
So maybe, who knows?
Possible. And then the last possible sighting that has any credibility was on September 19th, 1994, on a Basel, Switzerland train platform. A neighbor who had known Bishop and his family in Bethesda was on vacation and reported that he had seen Bishop from a few feet away. The neighbor described Bishop as well-groomed and said he was getting into a car.
No, that doesn't help.
Right.
Yeah, it's weird. I mean, you kind of wonder if these are just people that, you know, or have overactive imaginations or if
these are all people who claim that they knew Bishop in life. That's why these are treated, you know.
You know, I've had a moment
somewhat
where
seriously.
I've had a moment where I thought I saw someone that I knew, but it's really hard. I guess I don't know if you guys ever had that, but it's like you feel like it could be them, but you're not certain.
I will tell you this. It is hard as fuck to recognize somebody you haven't seen in 10 years or more.
Yes.
I'm just being honest with you. Like if you weren't close with them, like if you were super close with them, you'd probably recognize them right away. But if you were just like a neighbor or a colleague that met, you know, at conferences once in a while, the idea that you're going to immediately recognize somebody, it doesn't have a lot of credibility in my mind. Because I've had people that I went to school with and stuff walk up on me and I didn't know who they were at first, you know.
But, you know, if any of our European viewers, especially because all the sightings have been in Europe. But I guess anybody all around the world, you see this guy right here, if you've seen a dude that looks like this or similar.
Call the police.
Call the police because you might have fucking spotted Bradford Bishop.
Yeah, the hammer maniac, dude.
Bring him to justice. I think it's a little late for that, honestly.
I mean, I think it's 81 is pretty old. There's a good chance he's dead.
Yeah, like even if they caught him tomorrow, he pretty much got away with it.
I mean, yeah. Yeah, I would argue that. He's so old now that, you know what I mean? He's lived his whole fucking life doing whatever the fuck he wants.
Yeah,
who knows what kind of life he lived. Maybe he lived a fucking life on the run and was scared the whole time.
And maybe it haunted him. Who knows?
Or maybe he just went right on and had fun. Now, there is another case we have that we can look at that's very similar.
Oh, okay.
Where the guy actually was caught. And I did this because I know there's not really much of a sense of closure to this one, so at least we can get some closure with this next guy. This is a dude named John List.
John List. I think I've heard the name.
You might have heard about this guy. It's a little bit more famous of a case.
He's got the thousand-yard stare, too. The eyes, man.
A lot of similarities to our last guy, even down to the order of the killings. So let's talk about a very similar case where the killer was caught, albeit 18 years later. And the reason I want to do this is because I was curious, like, what did Bradford Bishop do after he escaped? So I think that if we look at this very similar case, we can kind of get a sense of what Bradford Bishop might have done.
Sure.
Because these two guys have very similar pathologies, and it's obvious from what I'm about to tell you. So this is the case of John List. All right, so he was born on September 17th, 1925. He was the only child of German-American parents. So like his father, he was a devout Lutheran and a Sunday school teacher. He worked as a lab technician in World War II. After his discharge in 1946, he enrolled at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, where he earned a bachelor's degree in business administration and a master's degree in accounting. In 1950, he was recalled into the military due to the escalating conflict in Korea. At Fort Eustis in Virginia, he met Helen Morris Taylor, the widow of an infantry officer killed in action in Korea, who lived nearby with her daughter Brenda. John and Helen married on December 1st, 1951 in Baltimore, Maryland, and the family moved to Northern California, where List served as an Army accountant. So after he completed his second tour, he went on to work as an audit supervisor for a paper company in Kalamazoo, which is just fun to say.
Kalamazoo in Michigan.
That's where his three children were born. By 1959, he was the general supervisor of the company's accounting department, but there was trouble at home as his wife was struggling with alcoholism. He later moved to Rochester, New York, to take a job at Xerox, where he eventually rose to the position of Director of Accounting Services. And then in 1965, he accepted a position as Vice President and Comptroller at a bank in Jersey City, New Jersey. And he moved his family into a 19-room Victorian mansion in Westfield,
New
Jersey.
So he was doing very well for himself.
So this is another guy who, obviously, very intelligent.
Yeah.
Obviously, very ambitious and motivated. Successful professionally.
I mean, he started off in the working for the fucking army to Xerox, which is, I mean, back then was one of the biggest companies
right.
in the fucking world.
Xerox is a huge company at that time. And he is the director of their entire accounting department.
Different kind of smart.
Yes. Yeah. A little bit, yeah, not the same, not exactly yeah. the same kind
numbers
of
numbers smart.
But this is a math, but still an intelligent, yeah. accomplished family man who from the outside looking in seems to have it all going his way. But just like the last guy, not too good. We don't have any diaries or anything for him.
What are you laughing at, TJ?
What? I was his wife's cockeye.
I knew it.
It's probably that what drove him mad.
I was the googly eye that drove
evil
him
mad.
Googly, 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 googly.
I want her eye buried in my backyard. It ain't hard. I'm killing old evil
think,
eye.
He'd be sitting across from the dinner
ICP
table.
ICP reference, y'all.
He'd be sitting across from the dinner table, dude, just looking at that eye and just thinking like, fucking, I want to destroy that eye. Destroy
the wandering
it.
Eye.
At night, he sees it in his fucking dreams. The eye. The eye is just always there.
The eye of Sauron, dude.
The eye of Helen is upon me.
It's horrible. She was murdered.
Yes, she was. But it was 1971. All right. I think it's okay.
The statute of limitations on joking about
not,
her brutal murder is...
It's not... Yeah, I mean, like, how many years... I mean, like, 71, that's what? How many years is that? A billion? So we're good. Okay, so on November 9th, 1971, while his children were at school, he shot his wife, Helen, in the back of the head.
Well, that's pretty much instantaneous.
Boom, just shot her. Yeah. Then, much like Bradford Bishop, he killed his own mother, Alma. He shot her in the face, just above her left eye.
Ew.
When Man. His daughter Patricia and his son Frederick returned home from school, he shot them both as well. So then, after that was done, this is how cold this motherfucker is. Listen to this. After that was done, after he'd killed his wife, his mother, and two of his kids, he drove to the bank and closed his and his mother's accounts, presumably taking all the money out.
Yeah.
He then went to watch his elder son, John Jr.'s soccer game.
Okay.
He then drove the boy home and shot him repeatedly in the chest and face. They say that the kid likely resisted, which is why his death was much more violent. But we should remember that Bradford Bishop also most brutally killed his eldest son.
Right.
So a lot of parallels. Killed yeah. Both successful, intelligent family men with three children who killed their wife and then their mother and then their children.
I mean, that is cold
hard. And both of them overkilled their eldest son.
And he fucking took, like, he's like, oh, it's your soccer game. Yeah, good job. You know, gets in the car, gets home, starts fucking shit. I guess they killed him at home, or did he kill him in the car?
Killed him. He drove him home and then killed him in
okay,
the house.
Okay, so like, obviously he went in the house, saw the scene, and probably killed him. Then.
Yes. So.
Okay.
So, I mean, like, really similar pattern to the murders. Extraordinarily similar. And, much like Bradford Bishop, it seems that List was going to get away with it. And he did for 18 years, despite a huge manhunt, obviously. Now, part of what played to his advantage is that maybe this was part of his plan, or maybe it was just good luck, but the family had been planning, I guess, a trip.
Mm-hmm.
So when everybody just vanished...
he had some cover time?
Yeah, everybody assumed that the family was on the trip, so it was a month before the bodies were actually discovered.
Damn.
Which
so like,
gave him, of course, ample time
to get out of the country.
So he really planned things out very well.
To get the fuck out of there. And the cool thing is, because he was caught, we actually know what he did.
Right.
Okay.
So we can talk a little bit about that. So once again, they did an age-progressed bust of this guy. This one, they actually caught him. And you see there that the bust is extraordinarily good.
Yeah,
it really
is.
It's pretty good.
They nailed right down to his glasses style.
Yeah.
And that's because the forensic artist, Frank Bender, actually worked with psychologists and people who had, you know, tried to figure this guy out and talked about how he would have his hair, how he would have his glasses, how he would dress, you know, that
kind
of stuff.
They got eerily close.
What his hairline would be like, what sort of, you know, because if he's vain, he's going to do a different thing. He's going to wear a different style of glasses. He's going to have his hair a different way. He's going to wear a toupee. You know, they need to know these kind of things when they're assessing this guy. And luckily, in this instance, they were just spot on.
I mean, yeah, clearly.
I mean, those look like almost the exact same fucking glasses.
I would base, like looking at the picture on the left compared to the right, you would think that the one on the right was made after viewing this.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it wasn't. So that was Frank Bender, great forensic artist who unfortunately died a few years ago. But he did perform the astounding feat of sculpting a bust of John List from an 18-year-old photograph to create an updated image of the wanted killer. When authorities were led to List's front door after this bust was shown on America's Most Wanted, by the way, they were amazed with the accuracy with which Bender sculpted List, right down to the receding hairline and the style of the man's glasses.
So he stayed in the country.
He did. When they found him, he was actually living in Colorado. He was living under the name Bob Clark, Robert Clark.
It's a very average sounding name.
He was still working as an accountant.
How do you get a name?
He actually just stole a name from someone he'd gone to school with.
But I mean, like, I understand, like, you come up with a name, right?
Right.
But how, like, when you go to get an apartment, you have to fill out a thing, and your social security number is a part of that, and they do a credit
check.
Well,
you got to remember, shit was a little looser
in the
70s.
Like, oh, okay. Yeah, I guess
you're
right.
He shows up with a bunch of money, like, I want to rent this place. They're just going to go, all right, you are who you say you are.
You know, and you know, who knows? Maybe he shows up somewhere and says, oh, my wallet was stolen, and I lost all my IDs and all this, and, you know.
Right.
There's some kind of process he went through to get that name. But maybe he even did it before the killings, because who knows how much premeditation went into it.
I mean, clearly quite a bit, though.
So he was basically living the same life he'd always lived. He was still working as an accountant and comptroller. He was remarried. His second marriage was not doing too well, though. When asked why he killed his family, he spun a yarn about losing his job and not wanting his family to suffer the indignity of poverty. So he basically said, oh, I lost my job at the bank, which I couldn't find anything confirming that actually had happened. And in fact, I don't think it did, but
maybe he saw it as the only way out of his family life.
But he said that his version of events was, well, I lost my job and I didn't want my family to be poor. I thought they'd be better off dead. So he was asked at that point, well, why didn't you kill yourself?
Yeah.
And he said, remember, he's a devout Lutheran, and he said that he thought suicide was a sin, and he hoped to one day
murder's not.
He hoped to one day rejoin his family in heaven.
Yeah. Oh,
I'm sure they'd be super glad to see you.
Murder is not a sin either, of course, right? I mean, come on, dude. This dude, it sounds like to me like he at the very most maybe lost his job, but probably not even that. Probably just like I want out of this family life. I hate this shit, and I'm gonna kill them all.
I don't know. I mean, it's not necessarily true, but I know that the whole mistress angle is a very common thing when this type of shit happens. For there to be like some impetus for them to get out to be with somebody else.
Yep.
And who knows? I mean, that might have been the case here.
So he was convicted, and he was sentenced to 5 consecutive life terms. Oh, and he was still a practicing Lutheran. I mean, like, he basically didn't change his life at all. He basically went and killed his family and then went and lived pretty much the same life under a different name.
Yeah, like, oh, I can't live in here anymore. I'm going to move to Colorado. That's it, really.
After he was convicted, he was sentenced to 5 consecutive life terms. He later appealed on the basis that his PTSD from the war is what made him do it.
Oh, got it. He got a lawyer.
Right.
is what I'm hearing here.
And the judge didn't buy that. He also tried to make the argument because at the crime scene, there was a letter confessing what he'd done, but it was meant for his pastor. So he said that because it was for his pastor, it was basically a private confession, and it never should have been admissible in court. The courts didn't buy that either.
Right. As well, they shouldn't.
Yes. And he died of pneumonia. At the age of 82, obviously in jail. And that's pretty much it. That's pretty much his life, I guess.
Hmm.
So,
He didn't have the linguistic talents of the previous dude. So
yes, that probably precluded him from going off and starting a new life in some
foreign
country.
I mean, you can't just blend into a fucking European country if you don't speak the language. You know what I mean?
Right. No. And but you know that he did manage to evade capture for 18 years living as Bob Clark, and it was only because of, I think, the extreme accuracy of this bust that he ever discovered.
There's really no disputing that. I mean, if this bust was shown on fucking America's Most Wanted and then somebody called in a tip to his arrest, I mean, boom, there it is.
Yeah, I mean, and if you knew this guy, and you knew, and they said in America's Most Wanted, like, he's probably still working as an accountant, he's probably, like,
right.
They went through this whole profile, and, you know, if you know a guy who looks just like that fucking bust and totally matches the description of personality that they're
also
giving you.
I mean, he made a number of mistakes. One is he stayed in the country, and two is that he still stayed with a job where he had clients and people he interacted with a lot. Like, if he had done a job where, like, he just kept his head down and no one really saw his face, or he formed no attachments.
He should have grown a goatee and become a grave digger.
He just started a new life in Colorado.
You know?
That's all he did. He's like, okay, I'm just going to do... And he fell back into the same shit he was doing before, so it wasn't really much of a difference. So.
Still involved in the same church, you know. Just, you know, not a very...
He was an active community member that people,
it's kind of a miracle he got away with it for 18 fucking
but
years.
He, yeah, I mean, he did, though. I mean, for 18 fucking years, all he needed to be was just his old vanilla, forgettable, milktoast accountant self. You
and
know
no
what
one
I mean?
No one raised an eyebrow.
Yeah.
Because who really fucking pays much attention to an accountant? You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, it's spooky how these guys can just blend in, you know what I mean? Even if you've seen their faces, you got good pictures of them.
But I think
we don't know someone's past. When you meet a person, you have no idea what they're about or what they've done. I mean,
right.
It doesn't
and how many
is.
People are actively doing this, like scanning the faces of people in public and hoping to find somebody that looks like somebody on the FBI list, you know what I mean? Yeah. It's just
right.
like a...
And, you know, but I think it's kind of interesting to me that there's so many parallels between Bradford Bishop and this guy to the point where, like, they even murder the same victims in the same order.
Yeah.
They're both academically accomplished. They both are professionally successful, you know, aside from maybe that potentially him getting fired, John List. So I just wonder, like, what is it in the psychology of these guys that caused them to commit such similar crimes? You know, is it narcissism? Is there some, like, sense of, like, they both kind of come across as entitled to things, you know? And John List, I don't have it in my research, but from my reading, he also kind of tried to victim blame at one point, saying that, you know, he was tricked into marrying his wife because she said she was pregnant even though she wasn't, and that she was an alcoholic, and that she had syphilis, and that he was miserable, and that it was really her fault it all went down.
What makes the parallel even more interesting, you know, is it happened in a similar time period, but obviously he didn't know about these murders and vice versa. They didn't realize what they had done.
Right. They didn't know about each other, as far as I know.
There's just a number of interesting things, like why they killed in the order they killed them, if it really was just a setback in their life where they didn't want to deal with
it. One thing that was interesting about Bradford Bishop, I'll go back to...
Well, Bradford Bishop was a lot more brutal, too. I mean, shooting someone...
I mean, he did it with a hammer, yeah.
I mean, shooting someone is one thing. Like, that can be pretty quick. Like, beating someone to death is, like... There's some terror there, because even the first blow, it's going to be like, why is this person killing me? Why is this person hurting me?
Right.
Right.
You know, especially, you know, when you're, like, the husband, father, son, whatever.
I mean,
fuck.
Shooting his mom in the back of the head is kind of like... Or his wife is kind of just like... She didn't even know what fucking happened. She was just shot in the head, and she was dead. She never even realized he murdered
But one
her.
Thing about Bradford Bishop that was interesting that I didn't cover in my research is there was actually a prisoner that was in jail for, I think, murder that Bradford Bishop had a correspondence with. And... it was before his murder spree, obviously.
So it happened before.
And but he was corresponding with a guy who was in prison for, I think, murder. And no one's exactly sure why. By the time they discovered the connection, the prisoner had already died because it was like a decade or two later. But by the time they figured out this, so they never really got the answers on that, like why he was corresponding with this prisoner, what their connection was.
I mean, this guy definitely had a dark side. There was definitely something lurking. I mean, most people don't become pen pals with, you know, a fucking murderer.
Yeah, just for fun.
You know, hey, let me just talk to this guy that's murdered people and kind of pick his brain. I mean, that very well could have been what's going on. It could have just been, you know, fascination with death or people who have murdered and taken someone else's life.
So there's obviously it's definitely a fascination there. So let's talk about a different kind of family murder. So this is the story of Sarah Johnson. So in the early morning hours of September 2nd, 2003, Sarah Johnson ran out of her home screaming for help. She told neighbors that her parents, and that's who you're looking at here, by the way, had just been murdered. When police arrived, they found Diane Johnson lying under the covers on her bed, dead from a shotgun blast that had removed most of her head. Alan Johnson was found laying next to the bed, dead from a gunshot wound to his chest. Also shotgun blast. The shower was running and Alan's body was wet. Based on wet, bloody footprints and blood spatters, it appeared that he had stepped out of the shower and was then shot, but managed to walk towards Diane before collapsing and bleeding to death. This is Sarah. Sarah Johnson. So when Sarah Johnson here first talked to the police about this, she said that she had woke up around 6:15 a.m., heard her parents' shower running. She continued to lie in bed, but then heard two gunshots. Sarah Johnson ran to her parents' bedroom and found that their door was closed. She did not open the door, but rather called for her mother, who did not answer. Frightened, she ran out of the house and began screaming for help. The police immediately secured the crime scene, including sectioning off an entire block around the house. In a trash can outside of the Johnsons' home, investigators found a bloody pink bathrobe and two gloves. One was a left-handed leather glove, the other was a right-handed latex glove. Her story of what happened would change several times throughout the investigation. Sometimes she said her parents' door was slightly opened, and other times she would say her door was closed, but not her parents' door. Based on forensic evidence found in the hall and Sarah's bedroom, both her and her parents' doors would have had to have been open. And that's because the blood spatter was so powerful that some of it actually flew into her room.
Wow.
Well, yeah, I mean, she blew her mom's head off.
So the idea that either of those doors was closed was totally disproven by that mere fact.
Right.
Sure.
So Sarah also admitted that the pink bathrobe was hers, but denied knowing anything about how it ended up in the trash, or for that matter, covered in blood. When first asked about the robe, her first response was to say that she did not kill her parents, which investigators found odd.
Yeah, immediately.
I'm innocent.
We found your robe. I didn't kill him. Wasn't me. She tried to blame the maid who had been recently fired for the killings. She also tried to blame a tenant who lived in the family's guest home for the murders. Interestingly enough, it was actually Nancy Grace who figured out the thing with the bathrobe.
Really?
Yeah, because there was a prosecutor that was talking about this case on her TV show, or actually I think it was a defense lawyer that was on this show talking about this case, and she's like, well, all the blood is on the back of the robe, so obviously that doesn't make sense if you're going to say that she was wearing it during the killings, because why would it have been on the back? So we think this vindicates her, and Nancy Grace is like, she probably just wore that shit backwards to protect her clothes from blood spatter, which is exactly what she did. And it's unfortunate, but Nancy Grace was the one that actually figured that out.
You have to give credit where it's due.
That's funny.
I mean, so Nancy Grace was right. I've never really said that before, but I guess it's the first time.
I mean, I think it's just kind of shocking that she's the first one to think of that. Right. That's immediately what came into my mind.
Yeah. It's not that hard.
It's like wearing it like a smock.
Yeah, she was wearing it like a smock to keep the blood spatter off her.
Is there any reason?
Seems pretty fucking...
I mean, her guilt is
but
obvious.
But no one figured it out until Nancy Grace, so you got to give her credit.
So... what about the motivation behind the killings?
So Sarah Johnson was described by friends and neighbors as a sweet girl who enjoyed playing volleyball. But another Sarah emerged over the summer months, one that seemed infatuated and obsessed with her 19-year-old boyfriend, Bruno Santos Dominguez.
Oh, he's a lady killer, I can tell.
Bruno Santos Dominguez.
She wanted a little bit of that Latin love, man.
So Sarah and Dominguez had been dating for 3 months before the murder of her parents. The Johnsons did not approve of their relationship because Dominguez was 19 and an undocumented Mexican immigrant.
I can't imagine why that would spark disapproval.
Yeah.
He also had a reputation for being involved in drugs. So on August 29th, Sarah told her parents that she was spending the night with friends, but instead she spent the night with Dominguez.
Ooh, steamy.
When her parents found out, her father went to look for her the next day and found her at Bruno's house, basically, his family's apartment. Sarah and her parents argued, and Sarah told them about, you know, she basically said, I'm going to marry, you know, Bruno.
You're never going to stop me.
Our love is eternal, blah, 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 blah.
You don't know love until you know the love I have for Bruno Santo Dominguez.
Yes, exactly. And so Diane, the mother, was very upset and said she was going to call the authorities and report Dominguez for statutory rape.
Ooh, that's not a good idea.
Basically hoping to get him deported from the country. So Sarah was kind of uncharacteristically chill about that. And she was also grounded, something that she'd never taken well in the past. But she's just super chill, almost like she had another plan. You know?
Okay.
Because a few days after those events, her parents were dead. So here's what happened. She put on her bathrobe backwards to protect her clothes from the blood spatter. She then stole a shotgun from a tenant living in her parents' guest house. She walked up to her sleeping mother in bed and blew her fucking brains out. When her father heard the commotion, he jumped out of the shower to see what was going on, and she shot him in the chest. In her mind, once her parents were dead, she was going to inherit the house, inherit all their money, and she was going to live her dream life with her lover.
Bruno.
Bruno Santos Dominguez.
Authorities going to show up, believe her fucking cockamamie story, and go, yep, they just they're dead.
The crazy thing is that the police have, I mean, I saw, there was a forensic files about this, and the police basically said, you know, if she had properly disposed of that bathrobe and those gloves, if she had, you know, either made sure they were totally gone before alerting the police.
Yeah.
Or something like if she had actually figured out a way to actually get rid of that stuff.
Yeah, destroy the forensic evidence, yeah.
And not just throw it in the garbage can outside. And by the way, the garbage truck almost did come and pick it up.
So that almost worked.
So they probably still would have gone, because the cops will do excavations of garbage sites and stuff. So they could have potentially still found it, even if it had gone away in the truck. But they might not have.
But someone thought to look, like, hey, let's look in the trash can.
They basically said if she had gotten rid of that evidence, she probably would have got away with it.
Wow.
That's pretty crazy.
They said there's a pretty good chance that they never would have caught her. They might have suspected her, but they probably would not have had the evidence to put her away without the bathrobe and the gloves.
Yeah, you have her bathrobe and her parents' fucking blood is all over it. I mean,
yes.
I mean, that's true of any fucking person that gets caught, though, right? There's always something they didn't think of.
Yep, and that was the one thing that she didn't think of, I guess. You know, it must have broken her heart, too, because her lover, Bruno Santos Dominguez, actually testified against her in the court case.
Damn.
Whoa.
So, the guy that she did all of that shit for was basically like the just totally like, nope.
He's like, nah, she did won. It. She's crazy.
She done it. She crazy. She loco ese, you know, whatever.
Damn. Dude, Bruno is a stone cold fucking pimp.
Yeah, dude, he is. He's like, look, you know, right is right, baby.
Yeah. He's got a heart of stone, that Bruno Santo Dominguez.
Yeah, dude, you don't fuck with Bruno Santo Dominguez.
Well, not to mention he was an illegal immigrant, so they were probably just like, you testify or you're going back to fucking wherever you came from.
Yeah, because it's so
How
hard
old
to
was
get
this
back.
Chick when she did this again?
I think she was 16 or something like 16, that, 15, 16. And I thought this was kind of interesting because you don't really see too many stories of a girl murdering her parents, especially not with a fucking shotgun to the face.
I mean,
chest.
Yeah, that's crazy.
That's fucking brutal, dude.
So she did not fuck around, and you can see here, you know, she's typical in the court. Poor me.
She got life, I'm assuming.
Yeah, I mean, she was. She got a life sentence. You know, and she appealed a few times. Obviously, the appeals went nowhere. No one feels too much sympathy for her.
Why would they?
So here's one that Scotty and I can relate to. This is Jim and Artie Mitchell. They were American entrepreneurs in the prestigious porn and strip club business.
Hell yeah, dude.
Oh, shit.
So at the height of their power, they owned 11 adult movie theaters in California. And they produced films like Behind the Green Door.
Ooh.
The All-American Girl. Ooh.
This is an important film, honestly. It really is. It's possibly the first U.S. feature-length film to include an interracial sex scene. So that's cool.
It was woke.
It's considered to have kicked off the so-called Golden Age of Porn, which ran from 1969 to 1984, according to people who got too old to get their dicks hard after 1984, yeah. I guess.
I mean, I'm just saying, oh, to have lived a little earlier than I did, man. I just missed out on the golden age of porn.
Well, actually, what the golden age of porn refers to is actually a time when porn was receiving a lot of mainstream attention and was enjoying a period of destigmatization in the minds of the average
cool.
person. So this is kind of porn going mainstream, and this is one of the films that pushed it there. The Mitchell brothers actually played a big part in that. The other movie, this movie and this other movie, which they didn't have anything to do with, they probably showed it in their theaters. But this is Deep Throat, starring, what's her name? I forget the chick's name that was in it.
How far does a girl have to go to untangle her tingle?
Ooh. Yeah. You know, no points for guessing what this one's about. This is, you know, this
it's
is
about,
actually...
It's about oral sex.
Yeah, well, it's about a particular type of oral sex.
Oil sex, TJ.
It's about oral. It's about anal.
I mean, think about this. Probably at this time, there was a good portion of the population who didn't know that there were women out there who could imbibe a whole fucking big dick in their
Well,
their
they
mouth.
Needed to know.
And this was the movie that opened their eyes. So
opened their throats.
It sure did.
Yeah.
Opened up them throats.
Oh, yeah. I think this movie probably gave a lot of guys ideas. A lot of women.
So anyway, the Mitchell brothers played a huge role in destigmatizing porn in America. Also, because the O'Farrell Theater, which was their main base of operations, was frequently raided on obscenity charges. There was over 200 cases against these guys for
Jesus,
obscenity
dude.
And other related charges. They were defended by Maverick attorney Michael Kennedy. And their vigorous defense of free speech, you know, whether it was selfishly motivated or not, helped to define the free speech rights of all of us. So these guys, as on top of being, you know, sexual liberators for the American public, were also people who helped to expand the interpretation of freedom of speech in this country, which is now being curtailed by fucking assholes.
An important contribution.
So these guys, important figures in American history, in my mind. Unfortunately, the guy on the right, which is Artie, was
jealous of the beard?
No, he was living a fucking. He was, you know, he was alcohol, cocaine, and just treating everybody like shit.
So basically, he was addicted to multiple drugs,
acting like a hot shot, just treating everyone around him like garbage, being a total prick. So on February 27th, 1991, Jim, the one on the left, in response to demands by friends and associates to do something about alcoholic, cocaine-addled Artie, drove to Artie's house with a .22 caliber rifle that he inherited from his father. And we're going to take a look at some actual. This is the first the murder trial for Jim killing Artie was the first trial in American history to use a computer animation as evidence.
Okay.
In a court case. Now, this animation I'm about to show you is very primitive by today's standards. But it was cutting edge at the time, which, like, what we're talking about, like, you know, 91, 92. So, obviously, it's...
Yeah, a few decades old.
It looks pretty ridiculous by today's standards. But we can kind of go through it, the events that happened once Jim busted into Artie's house. Now, Artie at this time is there with his girlfriend, Julie Bajo, which was his lover at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to take a look. This is the first 3D animation ever accepted as evidence.
So 1992, yeah.
The final presentation was accompanied by 54 seconds of live audio from a 911 emergency call made by the person in the next room. They're talking about Julie Bajo there. People versus Mitchell. Yes. And like I said, very primitive, so prepare yourself for the primitiveness.
I mean, pretty fucking impressive given that it's 1980s technology.
All right, basically his brother comes in and just starts firing down the hall towards the bedroom.
Right.
So the first two bullets strike the frame of the door, at which point Artie gets up. Another bullet goes through the door and hits the wall.
I don't know why he's walking towards the door.
he's about to enter this hallway.
I would not do that.
Which, I don't know, not...
A.K.A. the kill zone?
Would not be what I do. So he starts opening the door. Another bullet flies through the door as he's opening it.
And he still opens it.
He still decides, I'm going to go check out what's going on in this hall. And, of course, predictably enough, he gets shot right through the midsection. with the 22, at which point he ducks into this room like, oh, shit, I've been shot.
Damn, I wish I had a gun right
now. He's kind of trying to look and see what's going on. He's still just stupidly curious, you know.
Right, so who's shooting me?
Another bullet flies through the wall, goes through his arm and into his chest. And then he's kind of hiding away for 28 seconds. And then, stupidly, he peeks his head out, at which point he is shot through the fucking head and killed.
Wow. What a dumbass.
I know.
I can't even imagine what the thought process was. What's going on?
This guy have fucking windows in his house?
So at that point, he's dead.
I just cannot believe he went out and confronted someone with a gun.
So then for some reason, yet another shot is fired.
Like way wide up in the ceiling, kind of.
Like almost maybe out of anger or something. So then there's we can watch, you know, the top view or whatever. But after the highly publicized trial in which Jim was represented by their old friend Michael Kennedy, the same guy who had represented them in all these obscenity cases.
Yeah.
The jury rejected a murder charge and instead found him guilty of voluntary manslaughter.
Interesting assessment.
Well, basically, the case was he was a douche that drove everybody to the point of doing this.
Damn.
And it worked, I guess?
It did.
To a certain extent?
What was that guy? What was that Hollywood actor that killed his wife that they pretty much did the same defense?
Robert Blake.
Yeah, they were like, They were kind of like, wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Yeah, he killed her, but she was a total cunt, so it's okay. So before Jim's sentencing, numerous people spoke on his behalf, presumably appealing for clemency, including former Mayor Frank Jordan, Sheriff Michael Hennessy, and former Police Chief Richard Hongisto. So Mitchell was sentenced to 6 years in prison.
I mean, he got off pretty light for going into his brother's house and unloading on him.
Yeah, seriously. Like, it's just one of those things about the justice system that I don't think I'll ever understand. Like, this is pretty cut and dried. Like, I don't care what an asshole he was. You don't go...
You don't go shoot your brother.
You don't go kicks... I don't even... Like, the brother thing just adds to it in my mind. Like, right, you don't do this to anybody.
You know what, TJ?
There's a total disregard, too, because he just starts firing at the door, so he obviously doesn't care if he hits the girl in there either.
Right.
Let me just say this to you, TJ.
So there's not, I mean, there's not really like, he's not respecting anyone else's life either in his actions. So it is a pretty
Let this be a cautionary tale to you, man. You push people too far, TJ, and anything can happen, man.
Hey.
Uh-huh. Push people too far, TJ.
One of the results of Jim's trial was that the California courts allowed in a precedent setting decision, this computer animation we just watched, to be entered in evidence. It showed the positions of Jim Artie and the bullet impact points and the path taken by the bullets as they entered Artie's body. This was the first use of a 3D computer animation in a criminal trial. In his final argument before the jury, Michael Kennedy had attempted to mock the virtual reality reenactment. However, the success of the method led to its use in other trials, and now it's a staple of such trials.
So the Michael Kennedy guy was just like, look, this is ridiculous. It's fantasy. It's
they
not
just
real.
Made a cartoon, you know, it's, you know. But it's everything that's in that video can be corroborated by evidence.
I mean, he got 6 years, so his lawyer didn't do too bad for him.
Yeah, it seems to me like basically, you know, the town. I mean, it almost seems like, well, yeah, it was wrong for him to kill his brother, but his brother deserved to die.
Yeah,
anyway,
we can't not punish him, but does he really deserve like the rest of his life in prison? His brother was a dick.
He did 6 years, and he went back to the theater, and he continues to bear. I don't know if it continues to this day. I think that Jim has died in the intervening time. But for a while, anyway, it continued to bear the Mitchell brothers' name, even though one of the brothers is dead, murdered by the other. I guess he still respected his brother's memory enough to keep him on the sign.
Love you, bro. You just had to go to heaven a little early.
It's almost like having a lot of money to pay a really good lawyer is a good thing.
Yeah, it's almost like
that's a moral I
got
from this story.
Get away with shit if you could fucking find yourself a nice lawyer.
Because I got to be honest with you, I think if anybody that doesn't have a ton of money kicked somebody or just ran into somebody's house and started indiscriminately shooting and then killed that person would probably serve more than 6 years.
That's a pretty safe bet.
It's almost like there's two justice systems. One for poor people and one for rich people.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
who would have thought?
I wanted to pull more stories, but unfortunately, some other events intervened, and I wasn't able to pull quite as many as I wanted to. But that's pretty much the show. Kind
that's
of
a good show. What, TJ. Bullshit,
kind of a
dude.
Kind of a little bit on the shorter side.
They can't complain though, because they've gotten some hella long ones recently.
Right. So sorry if it's a little bit on the short side.
It was fun.
Did I actually someone we know that our parents know actually killed someone in their family?
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well, he actually
spend some time talk about that.
He was like the guy was like 25 years old.
Uh-huh.
He was living at home with his parents.
Right. Did he kill his parents?
He killed his parents.
Wow.
That what happened was he said you need to start doing helping out around the house more. He started doing more chores and stuff. So he took a hammer and beat them. Like I think he beat his mother to death, and then his father was going for a shotgun to kill him.
Who the fuck was this?
I don't want to say any names because I don't know.
Well, you've already given away details, so people can probably figure it out.
The deets.
Well, I don't. This is actually not the unique of a crime, unfortunately. But I don't actually remember the guy's name, but it was someone that like Steve knew, like he knew that someone in their family, and they had actually met this guy before, and he wouldn't murder his parents, basically.
Son booked with killing parents with hammer in their Slidell area home.
Yep, that's the story right there.
Okay. I mean, I could see his name here. I mean, I got it from the details.
I mean,
if
you want to put the thing up, you can.
I don't think that you've already pretty much revealed it just by giving the details of what you did. Having allegedly beaten his parents to death with a hammer inside their Slidell area home on Tuesday night, John C. Willis changed out of his bloody clothes and attempted to cover his tracks. Investigators believe the 25-year-old tossed the tossed the incriminating clothing on the side of the road a mile away and the tool in a nearby drainage ditch. He allegedly returned to his parents' place in the 100 block of Northwood Drive, tried to make it look like there was a break-in, visited a friend, and then invited that person back to the Willis home.
So they could discover it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, no, my parents have been killed.
Oh, you could imagine.
One of the big things that people do when they're trying to fake a break-in that really fucks it up is a lot of times they'll break the windows from the inside.
Yeah, you'd think about that, but I guess you don't.
Yeah, I mean, so if you're ever going to fake a break-in for some reason, remember, break it. You got to break the window from the outside if you want it to look credible. I don't know if that was his mistake or not, but... when the men walked in,
I think his mistake was killing his parents with a hammer.
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously.
Trying to get away with it.
According to the St. Tammany Parish Sheriff's Office, Willis feigned surprise at the scene before him,
but
authorities didn't buy it.
Oh, my parents are dead!
Oh, no! Hours after his friend called 911, Willis was jailed on two counts of first-degree murder, each of which is punishable upon conviction by life imprisonment or the death penalty. This crime begs for an explanation, Sheriff Jack Strain said at a Wednesday morning news conference discussing the incident. Unfortunately, there is none. Meanwhile, Scott Crawford, the son-in-law of victims Lewis Willis Sr., 62, and Helen Willis, 58, spent the day handling funeral arrangements and notifying relatives about what had occurred. We lost a very important part of our lives, said Crawford, whose wife Jennifer is John Willis's sister. We're hurting, especially over the magnitude of how it happened. Prior to the killings, there had apparently been an argument among John Willis, his father, and his mother over the son's failure to take on more chores and adult responsibilities in the household they all share. We need to get Stevie out of the house, dude.
Is this Stevie's future, dude?
Oh, God.
I don't want to fucking hear that Stevie killed Mom and Steve.
I know, right?
We asked him to do the dishes, and he just snapped.
He got a hammer and killed him.
John Willis armed himself with a hammer at some point, too. Yeah, so he struck his mom. They always kill the woman first. You know, I mean, you would think you'd go after the stronger person first, but I guess not.
Yeah.
Then he sought after his father in the hallway and did the same to him. Wow. Pretty fucking crazy shit, and not too far off from here. Nonetheless, Strain said, we feel we have the person. What was he sentenced to?
You could probably look it up. What's his name?
John C. Willis.
John C. Willis.
I'm going to look it up in the next window. Because I'm sure he's been sentenced
by now. This happened like 8 years ago. Seven and a half, eight years ago.
So a long time ago this happened.
I believe he was given life, though.
Six years for understandable homicide.
His parents were jerks, so.
Yeah, they were total dicks.
Take out the trash? More like death sentence.
They asked him to take out the trash, and he did, in my opinion.
Willis versus State. Find law. Is this...
It's probably.
No, that's Florida, so there's no way that's right. Yeah, I can't find anything about his fucking sentence.
Just look up a Louisiana like Department of Corrections, if you put his name.
Might be hard to find, honestly. I mean, I'm sure it's out there, but if the news stopped covering it after he was arrested and shit, then...
Yeah, this is a big story for the killings, but like most things... I mean, I'm sure there's probably a blurb somewhere like here is when he got life in prison or whatever.
Okay, let's see if I can find him.
Yeah, usually if you can search for like, do they... Like a database.
I ain't finding shit.
I could probably find it, but we don't, you know, whatever. I don't want the show to drag on.
I'm sure it was probably life or death when you go and murder your parents with a hammer.
That's usually what happens.
Life or death.
Either got two consecutive life sentences or he was just sentenced.
Yeah,
to
but doing the show,
death,
I even remember that that happened to someone that we knew.
That's crazy.
Or well, yeah,
that's crazy.
What was that guy, Paul, that you were talking about? Because there was another guy.
Fuck, man, I'm not gonna remember his name now. He's got such a normal ass fucking name.
But he was all over the news recently for killing his wife and his two kids.
It's not super recently. It's only, you know, a couple years ago, I think. But
it was only 2018.
Oh, was it? Sure. Oh, okay. Then that's why. I mean, yeah, there's tons of stuff about him, but his fucking name escapes me. I watched his whole confession, like his whole interrogation by the FBI.
Chris Watts.
Chris Watts. There you go.
Oh, Chris Watts, yep.
Yeah, that was a recent one. And he was not, he's kind of like the antithesis of some of the dudes we talked about today in terms of like just not being the smartest cookie in the drawer, you know, not being necessarily of an intellectual bent. But
yeah, I mean,
he was very cold blooded.
The reason
those other
guys got away with killing their families is they fucking vanished.
They themselves vanished. See, yeah, that was his thing. Is he wanted to make it look like she'd taken the kids or somebody
and
had come and taken the kids?
And he just wanted to continue living his normal life. Like
right.
No one's ever.
He had a mistress.
Suspicious.
He wanted to be with. Yeah,
that happens a lot too. So here he is, Chris Watts,
and he was really convicted. I mean, a lot on the strength. Obviously, he confessed, but the way they got that confession from him was a lot of body language analysis of the whatever the police's camera that they were, you know, the police cam that was on the lapel of the responding officer that first came to the missing persons report.
So the body cam footage was a major factor.
Major factor, because his body language in it is just wrong in every single way. And there's another person there to compare it to. One of her friends is there, worried, sick, frantic, looking in every room multiple times, even though it's illogical to do it. You know, like you would expect a person
just trying to do something,
right?
To
and
out.
He
yeah.
literally spends the whole time. The cop looks at his cell phone the whole time. He's just like,
there's a point in the video where he comes out with his wife's wedding ring, and he holds it like this. Like,
yeah.
What?
Yeah, he's like, here, take it. Like,
and there's another
not like
thing.
This.
Like he's disgusted by it.
Right.
Like
I found your ring.
I found the ring. Here you go.
And there's another thing too, and it's a really important part of the body language analysis. Is he finds her phone still there, and he brings it out, and he's got no problem handling it, and he's trying to look through it and stuff, and he hands it to like the friend for a second, and she reacts like it burned her because of the implication of a person just leaving their phone and taking their kids. It just makes it immediately apparent that something bad happened to her. And so when the woman holds the phone, it's like she doesn't want to touch it. You know what I mean? But he was just totally like, I found her phone, blah, blah, blah.
And
yeah,
also, he keeps just smiling, too.
There was a couple of instances where he just has this really inappropriately timed smile where you can tell he's trying to enact some kind of social manipulation of the situation, but he's forgetting that he's supposed to be a man frantic for his family who's disappeared.
He doesn't care.
He's like joking with the cop. There's at one point the cop goes like, yeah, is there like a pool in this complex of houses? And the lady was like, yeah, they might, you know, maybe she took the kids to the pool. And he turns around at one point and he's like, yeah, you want me to go look? I mean, I don't think that's what's going on. But he's kind of smiling when he says it. It's like, what?
I don't think that's what's happening.
I mean, everything is just wrong. And then there's a point that really convicted him where one of his neighbors had a motion cam.
Yeah.
And it didn't catch him doing anything illicit, but it caught him being the only one to leave the house that day. And it caught him backing his truck into the garage, loading what he said was tools into the thing, and then going to work. And then this woman and her two children just somehow left the house through the only way to leave the house, which was the front door, and didn't appear on any.
Yeah, didn't he dump him like one of his job sites he was working on or something?
He did. Yeah, he dumped him in a big steel drum or something.
He just buried his wife somewhere out in the middle of nowhere, and he threw his two daughters' bodies into oil tankers.
And he murdered them before
he worked
did it
on an oil.
Yes.
Rig.
Yeah, he murdered them at the house.
Yeah, he murdered the wife at the house. And
he strangled his wife and smothered both of the kids. And then right
before... I thought he took the kids with him and then killed them.
No, he smothered both of the children at the house.
Okay.
And then loaded all of their bodies into the truck in the middle of the night and went and disposed of them. And then he, before he actually cracked and confessed to the crimes, he's tried to spin a narrative that she had killed the children.
Right.
His wife, Shanann, had killed the children. And then in a rage, when he saw what she'd done, he'd killed her and then freaked out. But that didn't last the entire interview. By the end of that interview, he's telling them how he killed them all. Yeah, so,
which they knew anyways. I mean, right. It was obvious he had murdered them.
And right. There is another guy that's actually pretty famous who killed his fucking family. And that's Chris Benoit.
Chris Benoit, yeah.
Shit, yeah,
Chris
dude.
Benoit.
We actually covered him briefly on the WWE episode.
Not the greatest picture of him, but there you go. Not the greatest quality image, I guess.
And there were a lot of implications in Benoit's case too.
Right, because
one of them being
CT,
the drugs,
yeah. The steroid use.
Right.
Let me see if I can find a real quick breakdown.
Well, his
of
traumatic
what exactly
brain injuries. Probably a more likely
the
culprit.
Combination, yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean,
now we're actually getting up to a respectable episode length. So
I mean, HGH combined with steroids.
I'll just go. I'll go to the bottom of the barrel and just do the fucking Wikipedia.
Wikipedia, the show.
We covered that, so I remember some of the details of the.
You
case.
Remember how it went?
Yeah,
down?
I remember how they announced it. Like at first they were like. It was like the WWE was like. Remember, they did a tribute to Chris.
Yeah,
Benoit.
The next the day
like
after
everyone
his death,
believed he
they
was
did
murdered.
A big tribute episode where they fucking praised him and shit, and then the next they obviously had to totally
yeah.
rescind that.
And then
like,
well,
nope.
they have a big press conference, and the sheriff of that I think it was like in Kentucky or something comes out and is like, he actually murdered his family, and it was like, okay,
whoops.
So we basically just promoted a murderer.
Yeah. So WWE canceled their scheduled 3-hour long live show Raw on June 25th and replaced the broadcast version with a 3-hour tribute to his life career, featuring his past matches, segments from the Hard Knocks, Chris Benoit story DVD, and comments from wrestlers and announcers. However, once the details of the murder suicide became apparent, WWE quickly and quietly began distancing itself from the wrestler by removing merchandise and no longer mentioning him.
I mean, what do you expect them to do?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I mean, you can still see him on the WWE Network, but that's because he's in, like, the Royal Rumble, and he was some main event. Because he was a main eventer. He was a big-time
right.
wrestler. He wasn't
yeah.
just, like, some mid-card, no one gives a shit about wrestler.
So on June 26th, Vince McMahon actually came on the air and addressed the television audience and said that there would be no further mention of Benoit that night other than his comments. Basically, you know, they took the approach of condemning him. Obviously... you know, he was removed from, you know, everything they could possibly actually remove him from. You know, they didn't
without impacting the
they didn't go
continuity.
Out and they didn't go out and just, you know, remove all his matches from being able to watch him or anything. But
well, that would just be stupid. But yeah,
but, you know,
they want to continue monetizing that because somebody else will.
Well, also the other wrestler didn't he participated when you know
right.
he didn't fucking do anything.
And
this
are,
happened after he.
People
did
are still going to want to watch those matches. And
I mean, you know, them distancing themselves from Chris Benoit seems pretty logical on the face of it. But there's a you know that other aspect of it, the fact that he sustained these horrible brain injuries doing his job for them. And the fact that he underwent, human growth hormone and steroid abuse, allegedly under the direction of them. You know,
so
I'm not saying they're responsible for his, you know, family being murdered directly, but there is definitely more reason than just the uncomfortableness for them
I
to
mean,
distance
I think
themselves.
That's honestly why you saw a big culture shift in the WWE to begin with, because I mean, people were. I mean, they were doing crazy shit in the fucking 90s. They were doing crazy shit in the early 2000s, and it fucked people's heads up. That's why they don't do chair shots to the head. That's why they had to change it. And a lot of people are like, hey, man, it needs to be more hardcore, but honestly, it destroys the bodies of the people doing it. I mean, even the more toned-down version does. And you kind of see the ultimate result is that this is a possibility.
Yeah.
And it's not to say it's directly their fault, but, I mean, there it was definitely a contributing factor.
Yeah,
his
and,
career choice definitely was.
He strangled his wife and son, and then he actually hanged himself on his lat machine.
Oh, yeah, I remember that. He used one of his weight machines to, I mean, that, you know.
A lat machine.
Probably works pretty well.
In case you don't know, looks pretty much like this. Because I didn't know, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I think
I've seen this machine. I never knew it was called a lat machine.
Yeah.
I don't know how exactly you hang yourself from this.
Wrap
but...
your neck, like put a bunch of weight on the other end of it. Wrap your neck around the arm bars and just let the weight fall,
yeah,
probably.
I think it snapped his neck back and killed him.
Well, that's what he did. He went and he hanged himself on there after killing his family. A lot of times with these murder-suicides, you know, you kind of just wish, like, just kill yourself, you know? Like, why you got to kill your family first? But I guess it's the act of killing their family that causes them to kill themselves.
I think that's why people are so infatuated, not maybe not infatuated, not, so interested when something like this happens, because something like this is truly, like, so far from most people's minds, you
right.
know, like killing your mom, killing your spouse, killing your children. I don't have children,
yeah,
but,
I mean, but
I can imagine just the idea of
it'd be
that.
Like me killing my pets or something.
Right. Yeah. I'm sure
magnified.
Yeah. Do you
want to,
do you want to go home and strangle Dinor, you know? Or,
no, I mean, right, I'm an inherently non-violent person to begin with. So the idea of just like flipping out and hurting and killing somebody that I care about is just fucking so beyond
right.
me.
Right. And the thing about it too, is like, you know, you have guys like Chris Ben, like most of the times when a dude murders his family, he does kill himself afterwards.
Yeah.
Right.
But then you have guys like Chris Watts who
business as
usual.
Stupidly
just thinks he could just carry on with his life after murdering his family. And then you have these guys who are actually clever about it, who murder their families and go on the run.
They found evidence on Chris Watts's phone that he was texting his mistress while the cop was there searching the house for his wife.
So, I mean, like, just a totally brazen dude. Who,
so it's
for
just
some
like,
reason,
you know, the obviously
he thinks he's slick when he's not, basically.
Right. Yeah, crazy. So yeah, a diverse topic, honestly.
Yeah, I mean, there was tons of. There was way more stories I could have gotten into. I could have gotten into like the historical fucking Cain and Abel, Romulus and Remus, fucking shit.
Yeah, there's a lot of angles at this. So, I mean,
you know, there's tons of fucking.
This
stories
topic's not
out,
even necessarily
so,
done.
So I mean, we could the definitely well yet another fall. Episode that there could easily be a fucking sequel to. Just depends on whether or not people like it or not, whether or not they found it fascinating. I know people love this true crime shit. It's kind of interesting to delve into the darker side of the human psyche and kind of look at some of this stuff. So, yeah, if you enjoyed it and you want to see more,
become a patron.
Let us know.
And, become a patron.
And
that's patron. The best way to see more.
That is true.
And for people wondering about the H.P. Lovecraft thing, we're going to respond on Patreon to the Patreon winner and on YouTube to the comment winner. So if you're wondering about that, if you commented, go check that
and,
out.
And by the way,
if you won.
And by the way, you guys, thanks to all the new people who joined last month, you guys earned 5 extra helpings of content, so stay tuned for that.
Yep.
Thank you guys so much.
Peace.
Good night.
Good night.